This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. I'm DC Morgan, your host for this morning, and I'm out here in beautiful Sunnylands. It's part of the Annenberg Estate Trust, and it's in Palm Desert, Rancho Mirage area. And I'm here with Micheline Gallagher. Thank you so much for having me. This is such a beautiful day, and we're sitting here in the wildflower garden, correct?
Yes. So it's this is about an acre and a quarter that we overseed with wildflowers, and this year it is just booming, kind of wall-to-wall wildflowers this year due to our efforts and just by luck of being in a big bloom season this year.
Yeah, all that lovely rain, rain than we've had in 7 years.
Yeah.
But, we have a lot of yellow. What plants are these here?
So we've got a combination. The encelia or brittlebush is blooming right now. And we also have the desert marigold are some of the lower ones coming up. So those are the major yellow that you're seeing out in front of you.
Okay. Well, I guess we better start back a little and tell us about the Annenberg Trust and how they set this up. Because this area we're visiting today is more for the public, mm-hmm. And then there's the other more private area.
Right. So there's the two areas that we have currently are the historic estate, which is a 200-acre estate that was built between 63 and 66 by A. Quincy Jones. It has a Dick Wilson golf course, and it is landscaped very much like a Philadelphia-type countryside, So which is the traditional way. Historically, that's how it was designed. It's today is managed much more sustainably, so we don't overseed more than 50 acres instead of wall to wall. We've taken out a lot of the turf, and we've made a lot of changes to it in order to reduce our water footprint and just the overall carbon footprint on that side, while still allowing it to be available for presidential retreats, adaptive reuse, those types of retreats, and also historic preservation of a very important site.
Yes, yeah. Boy, a lot of top people have been out here.
And it's got a great history, yeah. I had no idea until I came here and started learning, and it's just pretty phenomenal. This side that we're on is 15 acres, 9.5 acres are a desert garden, and it's designed to reflect their collection of Impressionist art. So the plants are massed in single specimen beds that layer on top of each other, except for some specialty areas like this wildflower field and the specimen beds of cactus. So when you look at it, it's reminiscent more of brush strokes on a canvas.
Oh, beautiful.
So not a traditional botanical garden, so that's one of the reasons why we don't have labels.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. A family was going to come out here. There's really something for everyone. But they do have to reserve in advance.
They only have to reserve the house tickets.
Okay.
Sunnyland Center and Gardens, which is where we're at, is actually open free to the public Wednesday through Sunday from 8:30 to 4. There's no admission here.
So you just drop in.
You can come in and park. So we have activities that go on certain days. November through April, we have a lot of outdoor health and wellness programs, yoga, tai chi.
Oh.
Something we call Sundays at Sunnylands, where we put all kinds of toys, jump ropes, hula hoops, things like that out on the Great Lawn, and people can be out there and enjoy that with their family.
How fun. That's great.
So, so other than that, we have a lot of different programs. When it gets hot, we shift to evening programs where we do films at night out in the center and gardens. We also do music every Sunday in March. So there's a lot of thematic programming that goes on here as well.
Yeah. And they can just go on your website and read all about how to get, if they want to get into the private residence part, or just come in to the general public area.
Sure.
Okay, good. So now we'll get back to the garden where we are sitting. It's just absolutely gorgeous out here. There's cottontails running around.
Yeah.
Very quietly, of course.
Yep, lots of birds right now. Our bloom season this year seems to be a little bit delayed, so usually in February our aloes come into a peak, and they just did in March, and you can see some from here are still coming up. So this is a real delay. By now we would usually start to see the Parkinsonia, so the Palo Brea and the Palo Verde in bloom. They usually peak about mid-April. It's probably going to be delayed towards the end of April this year.
Maybe all that cold weather we have?
It could be a lot of things. Yeah. Okay. So, but it's just kind of, you know, it does what it will. Right now with the creosote, which are native here, are all blooming like crazy, which is great. That's a food source for our desert iguana, which is a large white lizard. They're beautiful.
Do you see them here very often?
Oh, yeah, we do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we do have some special programming on the different environmental resources that we offer. So we do bird programming. We will be doing a reptile program soon, a macroinvertebrate program, an aquatic macroinvertebrate program, and we tag monarch butterflies. We actually are one of the monitoring sites. We're helping with the Southwest Monarch Study, co-author study on desert monarchs.
Oh, yeah. And did you have a lot of them? Did you have like a...
Well, the painted ladies are coming through right now. That's what everybody's seeing.
Yes, yeah. We had those in Irvine, too. They were massive. Even in my backyard, they were just like...
That's what everybody's seeing, and it causes a lot of confusion because this isn't a normal year, that what you're seeing now. This doesn't happen every year. But the monarchs do come through here, and so that's what we're trying to figure out specifically in the deserts of California, is where are they coming from? Are some of them staying as residents? Are others moving on? So that's that program.
Do you have milkweed here?
We do. We have thousands of individual specimen of milkweed subulata. So Asclepias subulata is the variety for low deserts. The monarchs love it. We get lots of caterpillars, chrysalis, full life cycle here. And we net and tag the adults.
Wonderful. Yeah, we need to build that population back up.
Yep.
Okay. There's really something for every member of the family out here. As she was saying, you've added a lot of programs since I was here 2 years ago.
Right. Yeah, so if it's arts, on the arts side, I tend to focus on the science side sometimes. But we also, you can come here and do plein air painting in the gardens. We have workshops year-round, family days. There's a lot of a variety of programs.
Wonderful. The area we are in is called the Sunnyland Center and Gardens.
Yes.
And it's a nice kind of mid-century modern look to it. And there's plenty of parking. There is some of the art and gifts that different political dignitaries gave the Annenbergs, right?
Here for an exhibition that we did. The current exhibition is actually the Birds of Sunnylands. So we did a 2-year program with Tim Lehman, National Geographic photographer.
Oh, wonderful.
And he photographed all the birds, and it's an exhibition that will be on display until the end of May.
Okay. So they're...
It's a rotating space, okay. So every year there's a new exhibition. There are some permanent pieces in that, but in general it will rotate every year.
Okay, all right. Let's see. So tell us about the Sun God logo.
So the Annenbergs were inspired by trips to Mexico, and in fact in front of their house there is a column that is... it's actually a fountain, but it's a slightly reduced size of the same column that's at the Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City.
Oh.
And they saw that, they loved it, and they commissioned the same artist, the Chavez Morado brothers, to do it here and send it to Sunnyland. So it now sits in front of the house. But there were other features that were Mayan-themed features that were added to the house, the lava stone, the pyramidal roof. All of those were inspired by that. And so they also adopted this insignia, the sun god, as the logo. So that was selected by the Annenbergs. It wasn't something that we selected.
Okay. Do you still have the sculpture?
Giacometti?
Yeah.
So that's one of the permanent pieces. So the Giacometti, the ARP, are all pieces that are either at the center or they're at the house. So we have one of the Rodins here. And so there are a few permanent pieces that stay in the center and gardens. But other than that, they rotate. We also have a lot of interpretation panels, some kiosks that you can get information from. So it's a very interactive center as well.
Oh, and you also have a little cafe.
We have a wonderful cafe and store that is becoming more and more popular. In fact, it's probably one of the most things that people note when they come here. So you can sit in the cafe, you can have lunch, you can have coffee, French press coffee. The James, the manager of there, really does a great job in keeping that retail operation at the highest. It's really lovely.
Yeah, because there's so much to see and do here. You work up an appetite. You're going to be here several hours, half a day probably. So.
And you can just sit and look at the gardens while having your coffee or tea or lunch.
That's what we did last time we were here. It was so nice.
It's nice.
And we looked out over to the mountains to the west. And this year they have snow on them.
Yeah, you've got the San Jacintos on the west that are a great view from that space.
Yes. And there's pools. It's just a beautiful sight. We talked about the monarchs and the iguanas. Let's see. And at night you have a few coyotes, but...
We do, yeah. Well, and they're here year-round. We actually have a coyote coexistence plan, so we don't interfere with them. And they actually perform a very important function, which is to control some of the other populations that would wreak havoc here, so the rabbits. And we have not only coyotes, but we've had bobcat on property. And then we do have some of the predator birds of prey, so... from red-tailed hawks, red-shouldered hawks, to great horned owls that nest here, Cooper's hawks, really common, kestrels. So we do have a group that kind of monitors the property for us, and we don't have to worry too much about it.
Great. And I noticed you state that sustainability is really an important consideration in the design.
Right. So the Center and Gardens is a LEED Gold. We've also just completed the administrative campus that we're hoping to get a platinum on. It includes an engineered wetlands that will handle water on the site.
Oh.
And we also are part of, in our seventh year of being part of the Groundwater Guardian Program, one of the longest nonprofits to be part of that program. And that's monitoring all of the water to make sure that on the estate, the lakes and streams are not causing a pollution hazard, which is really important to us because we also are looking at a full sanctuary space. Walter actually, when he designed the estate or was in that process, had requested that the landscape, in the landscape considerations, that about 25 acres be absolutely directed towards a bird sanctuary, but also that just how the landscape was managed would be something that was beneficial to the Pacific flyway bird. So he was very much a bird lover, and he was aware of where this property was placed and its significance for birds that were migrating, making sure they had resources.
It's really thinking ahead. That's great. Let's see. So what about the solar field?
We do have a solar field here. We are investigating an expansion of that. When we first put it in, it was 864 panels, and this was 2008. And so that solar field's probably not going to be as successful as current ones just because of the time when we put it in. Solar wasn't as advanced as it is now. But as an endowed organization, we do take some risks because we have the ability to do that more so than some other nonprofits. So we put in and experimented with solar geothermal under subsurface irrigation systems, the engineered wetlands, and basically making sure that we're taking our stewardship responsible stewardship for water, land, and wildlife coming through.
Yeah, I find that geothermal heating and cooling fascinating. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that one, there is a challenge with it. We have 96 wells that go down 396 feet. And so depending on where you are, if you're familiar with geothermal, there's all different types of structures. But when you have one that has to go down that deep, it does require a heat pump to do the transfer. And basically what you're doing is you're taking heat out of buildings and bringing cooler temperatures in, and you can vice versa that depending on what part of the region you're from and whether you need warmer or cooler temperatures. So the challenge is once you have a heat pump, that's a large energy draw. And so that kind of interferes a little bit with the level of solar that we were hoping to get from our solar field. And what happens when you're doing this type of planning for a building or for a site that's brand new. So this wasn't a site that was there and we retrofitted these. This is a brand new site. We honestly didn't know how many people would be coming, how many days a year we would be open. And the demand for Sunnylands being accessible has been huge. So what we thought would be a very low number, we will now probably come close to or pass 100,000 visitors this year for just this visitor center site and the tours.
My goodness.
Yeah, so that puts a lot more pressure. So the systems that we modeled for, we modeled at a much lower level, and we're finding that we're putting a lot more wear and tear and a lot more pressure on those systems. But the wonderful thing is the public is able to come here free, enjoy this space, and the dividends in that are fantastic.
Right, because you can only lay by the pool so many, you know, golf. You need a little something
else. Back
to
nature.
Yes, back to nature. And so you are using as many natives as you can. Mm-hmm. Over 70 species of natives or?
And arid adapted, yeah.
Okay.
So not all of them are natives. Aloes are not native here. Some of the euphorbias are not native. And in fact, we are on a blow sand desert, so there's very few things that would be technically native to the spot that we're actually putting our feet on.
Okay.
So, but what we did use was, desert arid adapted species, that would not be putting a big pressure on our water usage. And then the rest are native. So we do have mesquites, we do have aloes, we do have, the Sonoran cactuses.
Yeah, I noticed you've got 15 types of agaves.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And what's really cool about their little brochure is they have a legend that tells you the size, when they'll be in bloom, wildlife benefit, and the human benefit. Many of them are ornamental, but many have medicinal uses the Indians probably use.
So, yeah, so you would have the indigenous populations here, the Kaweah and others, would be utilizing. I mean, the mesquite that's right behind us alone is a tree that is hugely important to the desert. It's a legume, so it does, on its roots, there's a process in which it can capture nitrogen and nitrates and put it back in the soil. So it's fertilizing the soil just by growing. The pods are edible. You can make flour out of them. Wildlife will eat them and then transfer the seeds. It's probably one of the most significant trees in this area.
What other type of trees do you have here?
So on this side of the property, we have the variety of mesquites. We have the Desert Museum Parkinsonia, which is the Palo Verde. It's beautiful. We also have the Palo Brea, which is the Praecox variety, and it's close to the building. And it blooms a little bit different, but both get those lovely yellow, lemony yellow blooms on it. The Palo Brea tends to have them much closer together, so the branches look a little bit more like wands.
Okay.
And then the Palo Breas tend to be a little bit more lacy and wispy. They're kind of spread out all over. So it's just a different look.
Let's see. Let's talk about the barrel cactus.
So, yes. So we have the golden barrel, which is the Grusini. We also have red barrel. We have fish hook and a couple other varieties spread out. The golden barrel are the ones we see the most at Sunnylands, and we use those. Because this side of the property is referencing the estate, it's actually a contemporary building. So the center is a contemporary building, but it references that mid-century look and the house. So we tended to, towards the building, have that kind of formality. So you'll see the Grusini planted in rows, so golden barrel rows. And then as you move out, you get more of those softer mixing of plants, and it's a little bit less formalized. Some of the beds throughout are done in rows to kind of break that up. It's a really different utilization of desert materials that people in this area aren't really used to. However, I now drive around the desert, and I do see some copying of this design in homes, which is interesting.
Copycats, yeah.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, you get inspired by something you see. There are some challenges because, you know, plants grow and change, and if you're trying to keep them in very formalized rows, you're going to have a little bit of a challenge with that. But it's still a fun garden addition to try to play with.
Yeah, I love the color combination with the yellow barrel cactus and then the purpley-blue leucophyllum that grows up behind that, and so it's kind of a layered look.
Right, so all of them are done in layers of, like, you have shrubs with succulents, with agaves, with euphorbias, and it's that layer creates a really different kind of a look, and it creates this really colorful balance that really does reflect that impressionist design, which is showing movement and color and light. And James Burnett just did that with plants rather than with paint.
Wow.
Although he did come here and paint the gardens too, because he paints as well.
Okay.
So that was kind of a fun circling back around.
Yes, yes. Now, what's your background? You said you like to focus on the science.
My undergraduate degree is actually art history. But I really focused more on the science side, and I'm more drawn to the science side of things. So I went back for my MS in environmental policy and management, but I've always worked at science museums or centers related to natural history, for a long time. So that's pretty much where I plant myself. But the humanities and the art history side has given me, different ways to look at things and to interpret things based on understanding that side as well. I think anybody who goes to school for science should be required to take creative writing, one art class, and a public speaking class.
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't always get those in the science degrees.
No. Tell us about the leucophyllums that you have here. You have six different ones.
Actually, we're down to three now.
Okay.
So we only have three at this point. We've replaced some of them. So some of the challenges here are the microclimates in such a large area. And we're seeing some changes in our climate that are causing some challenges, and that is with pest control.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not having the really cold winters that knock back our pests, we are having a lot more challenges. So one variety that might hit us once a year, and so we can deal with that and the plants can bounce back, may hit us three times now, and that makes it really difficult. And so some of the varieties that we've had were super susceptible to different types of pests, and so we've removed them and replaced them with the more durable. So some of the leucophyllums came out, but that doesn't mean that they're less beneficial. All of the different leucophyllum designs are, you can find one for every size garden. A lot of different, the leaves go from smoky grays to deep greens.
That's important for the home gardener to know.
Exactly. You want to, don't just go for Texas Ranger and take whatever's there. Heavenly Cloud is one of my favorites. It's phenomenally beautiful. And it gets a thick showing of purple flowers that the bees love.
And that gets about 8 feet high, 6 feet wide.
Right. And the flowers on that one grow very close together, too. So they kind of outline the branches, which makes it a very different look than some of the other shrubs that are in the desert.
Yeah. And it's good for butterflies, bees, birds, and small mammals. How do the small mammals interact with leucophyllum?
They can eat different parts of it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And it it's because it's one of the desert shrubs, and there's not a lot of big shrubs that do super well in the desert. Cover is very important for wildlife, for both birds and mammals. So it's places of shade and to not be seen from the sky by some of the hunters.
Yes. There's that palm tree, I forget the name of it, but it grows the big beard that comes down to the ground. And I always thought it was so ugly, but it serves such a wonderful purpose. Because for small mammals and birds, they can go in there and have protection. And
you can nest. You can cool off. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Cool off or keep warm, and no one knows you're there. So it's a wonderful display of how nature's protecting each other.
Yep.
So what are the other types of leucophyllum you have here?
So the ones that we have are the Green Cloud, the Heavenly Cloud, and then the Sierra Bouquet.
Okay. Well, you'll have to show me later.
Oh, looks like we have got a monarch.
Oh, yeah.
So that's one of the things we're monitoring. We've got a monarch kind of flitting through. So it's either a female who's going to be laying eggs and nectaring, or one of the males coming through as well. So, and right then a cottontail runs by.
Yeah, he's been going back and forth, that cottontail.
Yep.
Now, how do you tell the difference between the male and the female monarch?
The monarch, you actually have to see their wings. You can see on their wings. The males actually on, there's two on the black veining. There's a spot where you'll see two what look like little tiny bumps or like a whiter dot that are pheromone pouches.
Okay.
And so those are on the male wings. The females don't. And what we find is the male wings tend to be thinner veining with those, and then the female have kind of thicker black veining without those pheromone
pockets.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now you also have, do you still have California poppies?
We do. So that would be in, they come up sporadically in the wildflower bed. They didn't come up as much here as they have in some of the other sites that everybody's showing that are a little bit more coastal and more temperate. But what came up really big this year for us was the purple verbena and the dune primrose, which is that creamy white. And so those are the major ones that were coming up here, as well as a lot of the yellow flowers that are, there's a variety of those coming up.
So in the verbena, is it the sand verbena?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's the purple. Yep.
So, yeah, it's, and it blooms in spring and summer. It's good for bees and butterflies, and it's also a fragrant ornamental.
Yeah, it's a really lovely
and it
one.
It can grow in this heat, so that's...
And it spreads well. We also do have the Canterbury bluebell comes up too. That a lot of that came up as well. So the desert variety of bluebell is popping up, and chia came up like crazy this year. So that's really great because that's not one that you see a lot in large patches, but this year it has been coming up a lot.
Yeah, spring and summer, and it's great for butterflies and bees, and it's a food for.
The chia seed is something that is, it's a ethnobotanical. It was used by indigenous populations here, and it is also one that we use as well. So
yeah, you see it in the health food section, or
yep.
They put it in shakes and
yep.
rolls, and yeah, okay, the chia. You have to show me that one. I have not seen a chia growing.
Yes, sure.
Yeah. So tell us, what would you like to get out there to our audience about Sunnylands?
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize that we are open free to the public so often, and that it's a great place if you're coming into the Coachella Valley, to any of our cities. This is a great place to come through and walk. You can do, we've got a mile and a quarter of walking paths that you can do, and a lot of places you can get to without anybody else being around.
And it's pretty flat, so.
Oh, it's easy. It's,
yeah.
It is absolutely 100% accessible. And with wheelchair or any other rolling device, you can absolutely, go through here. We welcome everybody. We don't allow pets, so we don't allow you to bring your dogs unless they are an actual service animal.
Good to know.
And that is really important, because we do have service animals that come on site. We also have other wildlife on site, and so, we do have to have that policy very strict. But you're welcome to come, bring your family, bring your kids. We have activities. If you forget to bring something to do, you can stop at the reception desk and they can give you a bag with a blanket and activities in it for your children. You can,
wow.
And you just check it out. There's no charge for that. In May we'll have the evening movies. So we have 3 weeks, and this year we're doing Pixar. So we'll have Monsters, Inc., Ratatouille, and A Bug's Life.
Fun. And there is, I know at our hotel where we're staying, there's a lot of families, a lot of children.
Yeah, our movie nights have become very popular, which is great. Those are free as well. So it's Friday nights. Just look on our website. They're in the first 3 weeks of May. We only do 3 weeks in the spring and 3 weeks in the fall.
Okay. What's your most popular month in the fall? Would you say?
Probably, that's tough. It's slow in the fall because really our season starts in around January after the holidays. So our peak is really January through April. And then right after Easter, the population drops again. But families are here year round. We've got schools and everything. So we've got a lot of families that are here. If they are not vacationing elsewhere in the summer, we're actually not open. So that's not a time to come here. We close at the end of May, so June, July, and August we are not open. We will reopen in September.
Another good thing to know.
Yeah, and we are having an olive harvest. So on the estate we have over 600 olive trees, and in the fall we will be doing a public harvest. So watch for that on the website. It's not up there yet because we're watching the bloom cycle to find out exactly when those olives are going to become ready.
Oh, I may have to come out for that. That sounds fun.
Yeah, it should be great.
Yeah. Well, I need to take a short break here and do our station identification. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm DC Morgan, your host this morning for In the Garden, a show produced by the UC Master Gardeners. And I'm here with Micheline Gallagher. What is your title here?
I'm the Director of Education and Environmental Programs.
Perfect. Just the person we need to talk to. So you were telling me about the olives that they have here.
Right.
Tell us about that.
So just like everywhere in when you have olives as an aesthetic tree and you're not really producing, they would spray them that would stop the actual fruit from forming. So there's sprays that you can put on that will stunt that process.
So like for a parking lot, you don't want all the fruit
right.
dropping and it gets all over your car and your shoes. And,
so yeah. they would do that. And when the trust took over, we started having conversations about, you know, different processes that we were doing, why we were doing them, what's the benefit, what's the con. And after doing some research with the companies that created those sprays as to whether there was any long-term detriment to the trees or an issue of food safety, we discovered that we could stop and immediately start harvesting olives if they were to fruit. And they did. And when you've got 600 Mission and Manzanillo olives, you really have quite the bumper crop when they come in full board. So why not if we're going to utilize the natural resources to grow these, why not benefit from some way and let them go through their full process? And we did, and we have successfully produced olive oil, Sunnylands olive oil. We work in a partnership with Tom Curry and the Temecula olive oil. He is a biodynamic farmer. He's worked really well with us to help us with our process. And we actually do partner with, as I was saying to you before we started the interview, with the Riverside UC Gardeners,
right.
Master Gardeners, and working with us to hold a public harvest. We bring the Temecula olive oil mobile mill here, so we do the entire process on site. And then we're able to bottle it and produce it for public sale in our retail store.
Okay.
And
for
use on the estate.
Yeah. Do you have, actually eating the fruit itself, do you have a favorite, the Mission or the Manzanillo?
I don't. We haven't cured those for eating. We have weaved them all for oil and we blend them. So
okay.
we don't separate those out. But the olive oil is very good. So both of those are really good. But I haven't done a taste test with which one I would prefer to eat.
Okay. All right. Do you send it to some of the restaurants in the desert here?
We don't. We sometimes offer it as a retreat participant thank you or for other events. But in general, we do like to make it available to the public.
Okay. So what are the other gardens here? I'm looking at a map.
So we're in the wildflower field here. What would be directly south of that, across the drive, is a garden area that's our lower gardens, and it's actually a retention or a reclamation basin. So that is where all of our runoff water would go, and it gets captured, and then it can trickle back down into the aquifer from there. It can hold up to 24 hours of a 100-year storm, which is several feet of water in a very short period of time. We haven't had to test that yet. We haven't had that on this site, although we did have a lot of rains and flooding. It just didn't do it here. It was other parts of the desert.
Okay.
And then on the west side of the center, we have kind of a more formalized space, and that's where the one area of turf is for programming. And then it's surrounded by desert gardens, and it's more in like a Celtic knot design, so just a much more formalized space. But you can walk along there, and over there we have a labyrinth, as well as what we call our performance circle, which is another area where we can do programming, and it's, and so that's the basic design back there. So all in all, it's 9.5 acres of gardens on a 15-acre space and 1.25 miles of walking paths.
Okay. Great, and it's really easy to get to. It's right off Bob Hope Drive and right near Gerald Ford.
Yes, just south of Gerald Ford and north of Frank Sinatra.
Yeah. Well, do you have a favorite garden of all these and a favorite plant?
One of my favorites, I would say, is probably Lady Slipper. And that is because it looks like it was designed by a kindergartner. It looks like giant green beans that are twisting and turning, and it gets these really beautiful triangular-shaped red flowers that are sometimes referred to as a bird beak, but also as a look at like a fancy high-heeled slipper. And so it's just one of those fun plants that we get a lot of questions about. So it's Petalanthus macrocarpus. And it's just really a fun plant. But I think the changes in the gardens is what's fun. So plants were planted so that they actually change. So if you're here like 4 weeks apart, the gardens are probably going to look different to you. So like right now we're having the yellows and the oranges and the reds of the wildflowers and the aloes. As those start to finish, we will get the hesperalos coming up, which are all whites and pinks. Mm. And so it kind of changes that. And if we get a good rainstorm, the leucophyllums will add purples and blues to that color spectrum. So it really does change every year. And every month it's a little bit different, and that's really a fun thing to be able to watch change.
Yeah, so even if you come out here once a month or something, every time you come, it's going to be a different show. Tell us about, now, the ocotillo is a very mm-hmm. common name out here in the desert. Tell us about your ocotillo here.
So ours is absolutely loved by the hummingbird. We have Costa and Anna's hummingbird, and we do get rufous that come through here. And so that is really fun. We also occasionally will get a black-chinned. It's not a normal thing for us, but Costas are probably our majority. In fact, we already have identified a couple of nests in the gardens from them. And the ocotillo is, depending on the conditions, it's everything. It looks like it's a dead stick with large pointy things to, it fills in with bracts and feathers that are, feathers, leaves. that are really thick and give it a really beautiful look. And then it gets these caps of beautiful red flowers that are stunning. And it's almost like a fire at the top of the plant. And then the hummingbirds move in at that point and take their fill.
Oh, yeah. So it can get 30 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
And the blossoms, it says, is orange, gold, and pale yellow.
So the Madagascar ocotillo is one. The common one for our area is the splendens, the Caria splendens. And that one is, it can get about 20 feet high, and it's a bright red flower.
Okay.
And right about now is when you see them start to bloom all over the desert. There's areas that are quite, you'll see lots of ocotillo. They sort of gather in these patches throughout the desert. But they're really lovely.
We talked a little bit about the agave. I love the twin-flowered agave. Do you like that one?
Yeah, the Gemini Flora is very is a very pretty. I think my favorite of the agave that we have here is either the thorn-crested, which is quadricolor. It comes in, it actually is a variegated four different colors on it. And the fourth color is actually a pink blush that it will get in the sun.
Ooh.
So like the aloes that do that. So we'll see a lot of times some of the aloes, if they're in direct light, will get this pink. And what happens is a pigment, a rhodopsin, then it will be released and protect them from that green chlorophyll that's pulling in light, because they're getting enough light. And it sort of slows down that process and helps them protect themselves from the sun. And so we do see that a little bit in that thorn-crested. But there is one that is called black-spined. And it is that's the common name. The Macrocantha is its botanical name. And I like it because it is just, if you look at it, the shape is very different than you think of with the agaves, which tend to be curvy and elliptical. This one has very straight, rigid, strong lines. And it's very geometric. It looks almost like it was assembled, but it's a really different kind of look. And then it has these black teeth along the margin.
Excuse me.
And it's just really lovely. So we definitely, that's probably my favorite of the agave. A lot of people like the Perii truncata, which is the artichoke agave. And it's just an agave that looks like a big artichoke.
So. Yes. Yeah. The rosette of an artichoke.
Yep.
Yeah. And some of these do have some toxic compounds in them too.
Yeah, there's a lot of desert plants that do. The Asclepias, the milkweed, is another one that does. And, in fact, that's one of the attractants for the monarch. It has chemicals in it that are cardiac glycoside, and it actually makes them toxic and bad-tasting. Most birds, not all. There are some birds that get around it, but most birds will not eat any more monarchs after they've tasted their first.
Yes, I saw that over in the Scottsdale area. They had a museum, and they had the different crystals, and one of them was almost looked metallic.
Yeah, so the monarchs will actually do the green, but they get this little area, like a little line of little, it looks like gold jewels around it. It's kind of their little bling right there on their chrysalis. It's really, it's kind of fun. Everybody notices that, like, oh, there's gold. So they do, and that's, in. You will see that on the monarchs, and I believe the queens, too. So you, that is a common bright green chrysalis design.
And that's a warning to their prey, right?
Well, the orange in monarchs and that color, that bright coloration in general tends to be an alert that this is not something. But we also do see mimicry, and we see some species that look like others that are toxic that may be less toxic. So there's a lot going on there when it comes to interpreting. It's the same with flowers. How we see the flowers are very different than bees or other insects may visualize them. They have a different UV view than we do. And so we are seeing one world, and they're seeing quite a different one.
Yeah, it's so interesting. There is one plant, I can't remember the name of it now, but it will only drop its pollen when a bee, the vibration of the wings of a bee hits middle C, I think it is. And then it'll drop its pollen, and that's what that bee is looking for. So it has to hear that.
That trigger.
Yeah.
Well, so here, I mean, in California, so we have probably about 1,600 different species of native bee here. And in the desert, we have hundreds. So, you know, almost, I shouldn't say almost, every plant here has either a specialist assigned to it or a specialist and then others that are more generalists that can pollinate multiple. But it's very significant to make sure that those bees stick around because other bees, like the European honeybees who are not native, don't pollinate the same way, and they don't pollinate as well for our native plants. They've evolved with different types of plants, and their strategies are very different. They're important and interesting and phenomenally fascinating social structures involved with them. But for the desert, it's really important that we're focusing on our desert natives in order to keep these wildflower yields continuing and to keep that stock healthy. They're very much connected.
Yeah, you've got to have that balance for the food chain. And
yep.
Yeah. And every micro, there's the larger climates, and then there's the microclimates. How many climates do you have within this?
We know we have several microclimates here because we can take plants and plant them in one spot, and they do great, and then plant them, you know, 50 feet away, and they're miserable, and they hate it. So it's there's multiple. We haven't identified. Their lines of microclimates are blurred a little bit as we just notice it through plant behavior. And we've discovered that plants don't actually read the books that we write, telling them what they're supposed to do. So we can't trust the books all the time to tell us who's going to do well. But it's just a good guideline to start with.
Yeah. Okay, so we have some prickly pear, too, out here.
We do. We've got what the common name for the one we have is bunny ear. It gets beautiful yellow cup-like flowers. And it looks so soft and fuzzy and just like you could walk over and pet it because it looks like a nice soft bunny ears. And those nice soft little spines on it are called glochids and are the worst thing to try to get out of your skin because they kind of just disappear once they're on there. You can feel them and it's very painful, but you can't see them. Our recommendation is duct tape over the area and just keep putting it on and peeling it off and get out as much as you can. You probably won't get them all out right away, but that's your best shot for that type of a spine.
And yet it looks like the birds and insects, but and small mammals can deal with it.
Yeah, they'll get in there. Some of them can maneuver around there. We've seen rabbit eating different cactus with, you know, around the spines. They can maneuver, and so they do just fine. The black-tailed jackrabbit, it's surprising what they'll take on in the garden, but they are very comfortable with finding what they need in this space.
Is that the Mexican fence post down there? Or?
That's actually San Pedro down there. We have got Mexican fence post on the formal side. San Pedros are another one that are pretty awesome. They actually grow at several thousand feet in their home range. And we're, you know, desert floor here. So I was wondering when we added those how well they do. We've seen them around, and they actually do really well here. They bloom like crazy, these giant white trumpets that are stunning. They're traditionally bat-pollinated, but as you see plants being moved to different regions, you'll see other pollinators adapt to them, and so we see that as well. So the San Pedro are really lovely. The fence posts are as well. That white line that goes down each of their ribs is very cool as well.
Yeah. So what we're looking at is some very vertical type cactus.
Yeah, so those are columnar cactus, so they go up. So people are familiar with the saguaros. It's that kind of a look, but narrower. They're a little thinner.
And it's like a little forest over there.
It is. They're pretty happy in that spot.
Yeah. Under another mesquite.
Yep.
Great. Well, what else would you like to get out there to our listeners?
Oh, gosh, there's so many things to see here that I just think if you haven't been to Sunnylands and you're within driving range, you really should do it before we close, or you'll have to wait till next fall. But this time of year right now, especially if you're coming out to see the desert wildflowers, you can come here. We have some amazing wildflower shows right now with what's blooming on our site and around our site. So if you aren't adventurous and don't want to go out hiking into the really deep parts of the desert, this is a great spot. I'm hearing over to my left a Buick's wren. So we have tons of different bird species. We've documented over 145 bird species between the estate and this site over 5 years of tracking. So if you like birds, you've got that. If you like art, you've got that. Science, we got that. So
it's nice you can see it all in one spot.
It's not a bad place to come to every day.
Okay. Well, we have about 10 minutes left in our show. So I'm going to give you the ball to run with it.
Let's see. I would say that, you know, I talked a little bit about our sustainability features. I think that that's an interesting story that people don't always know. And that is something that if you come here, you'll be able to see it firsthand. If you go on the house tour and the open air tour. So the open air tour is another thing. If you can't get tickets online, which sometimes it's hard, they go very fast. We do sell day of tickets, which are open air. You can't go inside the house, but they do take you. You can see the house and you can see the landscape. And so that one is a great one to do as a fallback if you haven't planned ahead enough. You want to be here in the mornings when we open, and you can reserve your outdoor tour for whatever times it's running that day. Sometimes based on heat or other issues, the time of that will change. So that one is not 100% set time, but almost every day, unless we have something on the estate that conflicts with us going over there, you should be able to get on one of those tours.
Yeah, and it's so worth it.
If you'd like to do garden tours, Thursdays at 11. Okay. We do garden tours and birding walks and tours on Friday and Saturday.
All right. And so that would be like September through end of April?
We do those November because of the heat. November through April.
November through April.
The bird walks go through May.
Okay. All right. Well, this has just been so informative. I just love being here, sitting out in the wildflower garden. And
it's quiet. Today we're not open because we are closed on Mondays and Tuesdays, so it's especially quiet. So you have a little bit less, but once there's people in here, it kind of comes to life. There's a real wonderful beauty in that too, and an enjoyment in watching people go through and just enjoy the space, even if they're not doing any formalized programming. Walking through here is worth the trip.
Yes, that's what I did on my first visit, which was about 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And even my husband enjoyed it, and he's not really.
We get that a lot. One spouse is the person that's initiating it, and it's whether the other one gets on board or not.
Yeah. So, well, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your day. I know you're busy.
No worries. Glad to do it. Thank you for coming. It's nice to get the word out to people that we're here.